Hello, this is the Europeans. This is Katie in Paris. Hello, Dominic in Amsterdam.
You never went to acting school, did you?
Okay, it's not that bad. But I have got a cold and I'm feeling really sorry for myself, and so should everyone. Feel sorry for me, listeners. I'm sick.
Katie, that was really mean of me to say you'd never been to acting school. I should have just immediately, like, smothered you with sympathy. I'm really sorry you feel ill. It's horrible being ill. I'm sorry.
Yeah, thanks. A bit late, though.
How's your week been other than sickness?
It's been okay. I have an apology to make. I accidentally turned an unflattering picture of our president, Emmanuel Macron, into a kind of internet sensation this week. And now I'm worried that he might not be very happy with me and will probably never agree to come on this podcast.
Which was obviously lined up for next week, and now it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Damn it. Emmanuel's pulled out. We've got to find someone else. I didn't mean for this to turn into a thing. I really didn't. So I work for AFP, which is the French National News Agency, and an international news agency. And we had this great picture of Macron wearing a sort of dark grey roll neck. Nothing wrong with that, you might think. It's a sort of classic European intellectual look. But he had this jacket, like, kind of over the top of it. And it was all the same colour and sort of blended into one and looked very weird. So I just posted it, and then before I knew it, literally thousands of people were retweeting it, mostly with the same joke about him looking like a Bond villain.
Including me.
It's gone everywhere, like thousands of people retweeting it, and it's gone mad. And it spawned a couple of Photoshopped versions. One of them, there was a British advert in the 1980s for Milk Tray chocolates, featuring a man in a roll neck, like presenting a beautiful lady with this box of quite crappy chocolates. So that got photoshopped in to make him look like the man in the advert. And then somebody put a jazz keyboard in front of him as well, and that went quite big as well. And it's all my fault, and I'm really sorry.
It's a diplomatic disaster, Katie.
I didn't mean to mock. I genuinely think it's quite a good look. Actually, you know how we were like hunting for the quintessential European experience?
Yes. Do you think it's a roll neck top?
Yeah, like wearing a roll neck.
Yeah, I am not convinced that that is a European thing, but maybe it is.
I might have a think about that one and get back to you.
Okay, look into it.
How are you? How's your week?
Yeah, I'm fine. It was my birthday. I went back to London very briefly.
Yeah, you're old now as well. Welcome to the 30 Club.
Thanks for giving that away.
Sorry.
Anyway, yeah, it was nice, except that the trip was nearly ruined by a World War II bomb being discovered next to the runway of the airport that I was using both to get to and from London.
Oh yeah, so you were like there on the scene.
I was literally on the scene at the centre of a huge European story.
You should have done some reporting for us.
Yeah, well, I was a bit disconcerted to discover that they found the bomb at 5 a.m. on Sunday morning. I landed on the evening of Sunday, and they were like, oh, we don't really need to close it yet. And then they were like, we need to close it on Monday.
Oh, God.
But yeah, fortunately, it reopened in time for me to fly back.
That's quite an exciting, bracing start to your new decade.
It was all very exciting. And I did some investigative journalism in Pizza Express in Muswell Hill. As I put on our Instagram, I discovered that there is discrimination against gluten-free people. They only give you 5 dough balls if you're gluten-free, and they give you 7 if you're happy to eat the gluten.
That is a bloody scandal.
It's awful, isn't it?
It's really nice that this podcast is finally exposing the truth.
Finally. So, what have we got coming up this week, Katie?
Well, it's funny you speak about birthdays because we're going east to the Balkans. Europe's youngest country just turned 10. Yay. It's been a whole decade since Kosovo unilaterally declared independence. The nation is still very much a work in progress, and there's a lot of changes happening there at the moment. So, we've got our man in the Balkans, Andrew McDowell, on the line. And he's been reporting from there this week. So, we thought we'd give him a call to see how things have been getting on.
And then we're going to do our longest ever distance call over to South Korea to speak to the Finnish curler, Una Kauster, who's just been competing in the mixed doubles. But we wanted to find out about how it had been for her. And also, Katie was attracted to the fact that she was a curler who is also a professional hairdresser. So she curls hair and curls stones.
I feel like you didn't do that joke justice. It's an amazing coincidence. She literally curls in both her jobs. That's amazing. She is an all-round Finnish Wonder Woman, and I'm really looking forward to speaking to her.
But first, we're going to have a weekly look at who's been having a good week in Europe and who's been having a bad week. Why don't you start with a bad week, Katie?
It has been a bad week for the Dutch Foreign Minister. I'm about to wreck the pronunciation of this. How's this, Dominic? Helbert Zijlstra. Something like that?
Yeah, I think you could say it more in more of an English accent, actually.
Helbert Zijlstra?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he had to quit as Dutch foreign minister after lying about a meeting with Vladimir Putin, which might sound strangely familiar to our American listeners, the whole idea of having to quit over a meeting with a big Russian. But he had pretended, get this, he got sacked because he pretended he had been at an event with Vladimir Putin and not for pretending that he hadn't. He basically said that he had overheard Vladimir Putin saying something about having expansionist ambitions and wanting to create this like greater Russia that included Ukraine and Belarus and kind of restore Russia's sphere of influence to what it was in the 20th century. And it actually turned out that Helba Zelstra hadn't had this conversation or heard this conversation, and he got the anecdote off somebody else.
Naughty Helba.
Very naughty Helba. And he resigned, saying he was sorry for lying and he just wouldn't be a credible person if he carried on.
When he was first questioned about the facts that he'd suggested, he initially said, oh yeah, well actually I got it from a source, but I pretended it was me in order to keep the source safe. And then said source came out and was like, no, that's not true, and what he said is not true either.
And I also like the way that your Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, tried to initially defend him by saying like, well, you know, I mean, what he actually said is true. The message is true. So it's fine. Not so much, really. He'd only been in the job for 4 months, so it's a very short-lived career as foreign minister. But I think this whole thing has been really interesting, just seeing, you know, just the scale of the lie that he had to resign over. The Dutch writer Joris Luyendijk, who we're quite big fans of in this podcast, he was like, the Netherlands is like a country where ministers actually have to resign if they lie. And he suggested that maybe the Netherlands should invade Britain again to sort our country out, which I thought was quite funny.
Although, to be fair to Britain in this case, like, the Dutch situation is pretty unique because the coalition only has a majority of one. So if one of the coalition partners decides to kick up a fuss about the fact that a minister isn't resigning, then that causes a real problem for the government. Whereas in the UK, they have a slightly bigger majority. I mean, I know it's supported by the DUP, but...
yeah, huge majority.
But the DUP seemingly wouldn't want to mess things up.
So yeah, bad week for Helba Zelstra. Who is it a good week for?
It's been a good week for a number of out LGBT athletes in the Winter Olympics. There's been a noticeable increase in out athletes compared to 4 years ago. In 2014, there were only 7 out athletes. And this year, there was a grand total of 15 LGBT athletes, according to outsports.com. And it was the first time, actually, that there have been any openly gay male Winter Olympians, which I find extraordinary, considering there are 2,952 competitors. Having said that, it has still been a really good year for LGBT, despite the numbers being so small, partly because some of these LGBT competitors have done really well, and some of them have been very social media savvy, particularly these two American athletes, Gus Kenworthy and Adam Rippon, who've been excellent and vocal critics of the rather LGBT unfriendly Vice President of the US, Mike Pence.
And they're just really funny and nice as well. I like them a lot.
They've done very well. But there's one closer to home.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, who's our answer to Adam Rippon?
The European answer to Adam Rippon is Irene Wüst, a bisexual Dutch woman who has become the most successful speed skater of all time, earning a record-breaking 10th Olympic medal. So cheers to you, Irene, and to all the other LGBT and non-LGBT athletes that managed to excel at their sports without breaking their shoulders.
Hooray! I heard that she's in a relationship with another skater who's like a long-distance skater.
Yes.
And I was going to make a really clever joke about it being a long-distance relationship.
Oh, yes. Good one, Katie.
Just full of the Olympic puns today.
This past Saturday, the 17th of February, was the 10th anniversary of the independence of Kosovo. On that day, the Assembly of Kosovo voted to unilaterally declare Kosovo independent from Serbia. So we are going to call up Andrew McDowell, who is a journalist who lives in the West Balkans and has just been in Kosovo to report for a few very wonderful papers.
We do normally, as a rule, try to feature people on this podcast who are from whatever country they're in. He is British. We're very sorry about that. But he's just really good at explaining things. So we thought we'd make a little exception for him.
That sounds like we're really like, oh, okay. No, we're really grateful that he's come on to talk because he's really super clever and knowledgeable about this.
He is excellent. To my shame, there's a lot more I could learn about Kosovo, you know? We were kids when the war happened. I've travelled a little bit in the Balkans, but I've never been to Kosovo and the sort of lingering scars of that conflict.
Yeah, I think like we all knew about Milosevic. Well, people of our age, Katie, I'm talking about. And we knew about Milosevic growing up vaguely as this like monstrous figure. but I didn't actually know anything about the details when I was growing up. And when I was starting to read up for this interview today, I realised that there's quite a lot I missed.
Oh yeah, there's loads. And I think, to be honest, these days, if you say Kosovo, I think the probably youngish people might know that Rita Ora is from Kosovo. Did you know that?
And Dua Lipa.
Who's that?
Isn't that a rapper?
Is it?
An English singer-songwriter.
I'm not very young.
Yeah, she's English but also Kosovan.
Before we call Andy, can I just tell you my two things that I think are really interesting about Kosovo?
Please do.
One, they've got three dialing codes. Isn't that a complete nightmare? Because Serbia doesn't recognise them as a country, so they've made it quite difficult for them to get a dialing code.
Oh.
So if I wanted to call you on like the other side of our own country, I'd have to call a different code, which is slightly annoying. But they are starting to use their own one now. So that's good. And also, they've got this massive diaspora population, which I wasn't really aware of. So the whole country itself has only got a population of 1.8 million, but there's 700,000 living elsewhere in Europe. Quite a lot of them in Germany, I think, or Switzerland.
Wow.
Anyway, should we give Andy a call?
Yeah.
Hello.
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 Could you maybe give us a sort of beginner's guide, a cheat sheet to Kosovo in terms of how it, what's the story of it declaring independence unilaterally 10 years ago?
How long have you got?
Give us a sort of like person with a really short attention span's explanation, please.
Well, there was a war fought in the late 90s between the Yugoslav state and Serb-demolited Yugoslav state and the Kosovo Liberation Army, predominantly ethnic Albanian, for Kosovo's independence. Due to what was happening on the ground, NATO intervened and for a fairly lengthy bombing campaign against Serbia, which is still hugely controversial in Serbia, that led to Serb forces being withdrawn from Kosovo. From then on, it was very much under the tutelage of international institutions, including the UN, many of whom are still heavily present. But there was widespread support in countries like the UK, the US and Germany for Kosovo eventually to become independent. So while its declaration of independence was, as the Serbs will say, unilateral, it did have support from influential international powers.
This Saturday, the 17th of February, was the 10th anniversary. I was wondering, do you think there's anything for Kosovans to celebrate?
Well, on the streets of Pristina, certainly a lot of people did feel there was quite a lot to celebrate. For them, it was a hard-fought independence. And in some cases, I think something that they'd aspired to for decades, if not centuries. So people are excited and proud.
Where did you actually go this time when you were in Kosovo, Andy?
I went to Pristina. I also went to Mitrovica, the divided city in the north of the country. And I went out to Visoki Dečani Monastery in the west.
And did you find the mood quite different in those different places in terms of how people were seeing the anniversary?
Yes, I mean, in the north, in northern Mitrovica, which is predominantly Serb, people were very sceptical. They either said they weren't interested or they said they opposed it. On Pristina streets, the feelings were also mixed, but in a different way. Some people were merely filled with joy and excitement, whereas others said they had rather mixed feelings because they felt that Kosovo hadn't moved forward as much as they'd hoped for originally. And some said that the past 10 years had in many ways been a failure.
How does it work in the more divided parts of the country? How divided is it? Do they have different schools for the Serbs and the Albanians, or is it slightly more blended than that?
Well, it really depends on the region. In northern Mitrovica, it's almost as if one's in Serbia. The currency is the Serbian dinar, though one can use euros. Most cars have Serbian number plates. Serbian state utilities provide many of the utilities there, and people learn Serbian and Serbian spoken on the streets, though Albanians do live there as well. Relations have improved quite a lot since independence, but still there's a degree of division.
I saw that the German foreign minister a few days ago was holding a press conference, I think, in Pristina. He was talking quite optimistically about persuading the rest of the international community to recognise Kosovo as an independent nation. Some of our listeners will know, but many won't. It's only 57% of the United Nations member states recognise Kosovo as an independent state.
It's not even all of the EU, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not.
It's only 23 members, I think, out of 28.
So do you think there is any possibility that there could be progress in the near future towards persuading more countries to diplomatically recognise Kosovo as independent?
Some people actually see a backsliding. There's been some questions over some smaller countries, news that they might even rescind their recognition of Kosovo. As you said, there are several EU member states that don't recognise Kosovo. One of them is Spain, which obviously has its own internal issues with Catalonia and the Basque country. So Spain has been quite instrumental, I think, in watering down the European Union's approach to Kosovo. Mm. Having said that, the Kosovo government is confident that it can make progress, and it believes that much will hinge on that relationship with Belgrade, and that that will help dominoes start to fall. Once there is a deal with Serbia, it will become harder for other countries not to recognise Kosovo.
Does it feel like there's an appetite on the ground in Kosovo for EU membership? I know it would be quite a long way off.
Statistically, support for EU accession in Kosovo is very high. I think increasingly people have fewer illusions that it will happen immediately. I think there was a sense when independence was declared that it might be quicker. There's an awareness that Kosovo support comes from the EU and the US, and that Kosovo needs to stay with them because it doesn't have a huge number of other friends.
And would there be any other barriers other than the fact that they need to be recognised as an independent state? Are there other barriers to the way that Kosovo is run that might put the EU off allowing them to be a member? I don't know, about press freedom or
corruption, stuff like that, I'm guessing.
Corruption, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Kosovo has many of the issues that other countries in the Western Balkans have that it has to face, from judicial and economic reform and bringing its laws up to EU standards, to tackling corruption and organised crime, to democratisation, protection of minorities. And in many of the countries in this region, things are happening on paper, but people ask if the institutions are really upgrading. So these are serious challenges for these countries, many of whom have fairly young institutions, Kosovo being the prime example of that.
In a sign of progress, I see that Kosovo have had their first appearance in the Winter Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
They sent one competitor. He's a student of dentistry and an Olympian of alpine skiing, Albin Tahir, and he is the 29-year-old son of a Kosovo-Albanian father and a Slovenian mother. But he grew up in Slovenia, but decided to compete under his father's country. I was wondering if, when you were in Kosovo, you heard anything about him competing, seeing as you were there at the time.
I heard a little, but certainly one of the things that people in Kosovo are most proud of, their sports people. One person actually said to me, other than our singers like Rita Ora and Dua Lipa, the only thing we have to be proud of over the past 10 years is our sports players. And many of them play, for example, for Switzerland, where there's a big Kosovo-Albanian community. So I think that that sporting recognition is important to people from Kosovo, for Kosovo-Albanians.
If you were going to Kosovo as a sort of visitor, as a traveller, a tourist, instead of for work, where would you recommend that people go?
There's plenty, yes. Pristina is, it's not in all parts a beautiful city, but it's certainly a lively one. Kosovo has the youngest average population in Europe, which feeds into a good bar and restaurant scene. Some people say it has the best restaurants in the Balkans. Then there are wonderful mountains, particularly in the west of the country, where you can go snowshoeing, you can go skiing in Brezovica in the south. There are beautiful small Ottoman towns like Prizren, which has some well-preserved Ottoman architecture. And, of course, some of the most important Serbian monasteries, for example, the Patriarchate of Pec, and the Visoki Dečani Monastery, which I visited as part of my trip. So there are cultural and natural attractions and plenty of good nightlife as well.
Well, that's good. We might not hit the ski slopes because we've had some slightly traumatic experiences with skiing on this podcast. But the rest sound great. Thanks, Andy.
So look out for Andrew's article in The Guardian about Kosovo. It should be out by time of publication, in which case we will be sure to put a link to it on our Facebook page, which you can find by searching The Europeans, and on our Twitter, at EuropeansPod.
Since we've been talking about that lovely skier in Kosovo, should we stick with the Winter Olympics for a bit?
Let's do that and speak to a real-life Olympian.
Oh, I have been a little bit obsessed with the curling this week. I think you took some convincing to talk about curling.
Yeah.
I think it can be justified as a European topic because it's really European teams, Dominic, that dominate the International Curling League.
And it was invented in Scotland.
And it is a Scottish invention. People in like 16th century Scotland used to play it by sliding like big rocks on frozen ponds and stuff.
But don't you just like it because it doesn't look like you're going to break any limbs doing it, unlike most of the things in the Winter Olympics? I mean, that's why I personally like it.
This is one you could be safe with.
I'm projecting, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to admit, even though it is definitely a sport which requires a lot of athleticism, it does look quite funny to watch, and people are always making jokes about it looking like housework on ice. But it's true, it needs athleticism, it needs brains. People call it chess on ice because you need to like make calculations all the time. And Dominic, I think it can be justified as a sexy sport as well. My favourite headline of this week was in our favourite newspaper, The Daily Express. A stunning curler who looks like Angelina Jolie wins medal at Winter Olympics. Isn't that lovely?
Oh my God.
She does look like Angelina Jolie.
And did you see that the curler that we're about to speak to, Una Kauster, there was a little bit of a Twitter storm around her because she's a hairdresser. She had her hair done up really nicely in every round. And there were some pictures where people realised that she looked identical to Elsa from Frozen.
She is a curling princess. I think Una is amazing. She's like a kind of superwoman. As you say, she is a full-time hairdresser and makeup artist. And also, it's quite interesting because she's been competing in the mixed doubles, which is a new thing this year. And do you know what I've been learning about mixed doubles?
No.
It's much more exciting than normal curling because it's shorter, only 22 minutes long, which I think is nice for like the whole millennial age group that doesn't have a very long attention span. And it's nice because there's only two of them. They have to shout at each other quite a lot. So there's the USA team is quite funny because they've got a brother and sister team. So they're just like, they've got this really nice...
They're just bickering.
They're just bickering all the time. And at one point you can hear him saying to her, like, don't you roll your eyes at me. And it's just really funny.
Oh, that's great.
So we're going to give Una a call. She very kindly agreed to give us a call all the way from South Korea.
Hello.
Hello.
How's it going? How are you?
Everything fine. I was just watching women's curling here in Gangneung. And, well, there were some super surprise winning games. And, yeah, it was quite interesting.
And so it's not such a big thing in Finland, is it? How did you get involved in curling?
I actually don't know how old I was when I started, but... quite young. My father already started to play curling, and after that all the family has been playing, so it has been a family hobby for me, and that's how all started. I was just small kid playing around in the curling ring.
This is actually like a kind of, well, just one of two jobs for you, right? Because you are a full-time hairdresser and makeup artist. How do you balance these two careers? You must have a very hectic schedule.
Yeah. So last half year, I have been playing more curling than working. But before that, I have been working full-time hairdresser and makeup artist for Finnish television. And my days have been full of work and practicing, so it has been quite hectic.
Obviously, you're competing for Finland, but we are a European podcast, and we like to ask people if they feel like Europeans and if there is any sense of European community. And I wonder, when you're out there at the Olympic Games, do you feel like there is a sense of community amongst the European teammates or even amongst the Scandinavian teammates, maybe?
Yeah, of course. Now in the team curling, there is no Finnish teams playing. So, of course, I'm cheering for European teams and for Scandinavian teams. So we are one group and cheering for each other, of course, if there's not our own country.
Una, talk us through your daily training routine, because I think a lot of people don't realise what an athletic sport curling is. It's like it's very strenuous, right?
Well, in wintertime, when we have our season going on, I'm doing 5 or 6 days curling practice on ice. Then in the summertime, I'm putting all the effort for gym training and for the other sports In every week, I have one day of rest, and the other days I'm practicing a lot.
I was encouraged to see that your curling partner, he made some headlines as well, because he made his Olympic debut just before turning 50. And I think he's one of the oldest people to debut at the Olympics. I thought that was so nice to see that there's a sport in which someone at age 49 is able to start their Olympic career. And it made me think that maybe Katie and I have a chance. if we started working now, do you think we could get there, or is it the kind of thing you have to have been doing since you were a child?
I don't know what you have been doing before, but of course it's possible. Like Tommy is in a really good shape, so he has been doing sport, I think, all his life. So he's oldest athlete here, but it's not just how old are you, it's like what you have been doing before this. So if you start practicing now, everything is possible.
It does sound like Tommy has a head start on us, yeah. Though, Dominic. I think we need to get to the gym like tomorrow, yeah, if we want to have any chance. Where can people try? Do you have to go to like a specialist facility to try it, or do they do it at ice rinks in most European countries?
Yes, you need curling ice. It's a little bit different than ice hockey ice, so you really need to have that special curling ice to play curling. But sometimes they are doing also hockey arenas like one night in a week curling ice. It's not that good, but it's when you are trying first time, it actually doesn't matter what kind of the ice is.
What do you say to people, you know, who make jokes about curling and say it looks silly? Like, what's your response to that?
It looks funny, and they are actually quite often asking if I'm cleaning all the time at home and something like this, but I'm not really. Yeah, it looks funny, but it's really nice sport, and when people are trying curling, they can find how fun it is.
Sorry.
Are you okay?
I'm dying.
This is when it's really horrible that we're like hundreds of miles apart, because I want to just give you a big pat on the back and help you cough more, although I don't think that actually helps.
No, you don't. You don't want to be anywhere near me.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Singers are always like, germs, get away from me. You're like the least sympathetic friends ever.
It's so true. I cannot afford to get ill right now. I'm too busy. But anyway, maybe you're not ill. This is such a smooth segue. Maybe you're not ill, and actually, you're just suffering from the awful pollution that they have in 130 cities across Europe.
This is definitely one of them, but go on.
This is definitely one of them. And Germany has quite a few of them as well. And soon the EU are considering fining various cities for the illegal levels of toxic pollution. Like, for example, in London this year, at the end of the first month, at the end of January, Brixton Road had already reached its legal limit for nitrogen dioxide.
What, for like the whole year?
For the whole year, ready to like carry on pumping out the awful pollution and causing many early deaths.
Yeah.
I think it's 23,000 in the UK. That's the estimate. Anyway, this is meant to be the happy ending, if you hadn't realised.
Get on with it then.
The happy side of this story is the fact that the German government have sent a letter to the EU in which they were outlining some steps on how to solve this pollution problem. And they are considering making all public transport free.
Wow.
Cheering sound.
Okay. Yay. That sounds really expensive.
Yeah, and I think it is really expensive. And I think it's like at a really early stage and it shouldn't have actually been made public yet. I think it was a bit of a mistake.
Oh, did it get leaked?
Well, it was a letter that some German officials sent to the EU, and I'm not sure quite how various press outlets got it. But yeah, according to this letter, the policy would start out with a trial period in five cities: Essen, Reutlingen, Mannheim, and Herrenberg. Oh, I missed out Bonn at the beginning. And the hope is that people will obviously start using their cars less, and that the air will become much cleaner. As you say, it will be very expensive. It will cost dozens of billions of euros, I think. And it's at a very early stage of planning, so early that some of the local municipalities were a little bit surprised to see this in the press, because it may have been like mentioned, but they were like, what? This is not something that's happening.
It does sound like a nice idea. I wonder how many people would give up their cars. I mean, I suppose like most people really, apart from super rich people.
I think quite a lot of people would do, but actually I'm always surprised. My dad's got a Freedom Pass. I'm always surprised how much he still likes using the car.
Really?
Oh my God, have I given away my dad's age?
And you've given away the fact that he's a gas-guzzling roadhog.
No, and that's not true either.
Shout out to the dad. Oh, we haven't given any shout-outs to our dads yet. That's the first one.
No, we haven't. And now I feel really mean because it was a cruel one. But at least now I can Tell him he's actually listening to the podcast.
German public transport. I think it's a great idea. And I can't wait for it to come in so that you and me can go on loads of amazing German holidays.
Where we just like sit on the tube all day.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
Holiday-tastic.
Well, thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. This is our 11th episode, I think.
Lucky number 11. Only one episode older than Kosovo is years.
Yeah.
That was good, wasn't it?
That was really good, Katie. You should definitely stay in. Thank you to our guests, Una and Andrew. Please check out Andrew's articles in The Guardian. As we said earlier, we'll be tweeting links to them.
And go curling. It'll make Una really, really happy.
Exactly. If you just Google, you'll find your closest curling venue very easily.
I am genuinely fascinated to find out where my closest curling rink is. Have a great week, everyone, and we will see you on Tuesday for more European fun.
Hope you feel better, Katie.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Una. Safe trip home.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, Una.
Hello.
Quick question. Sorry. Do you happen to know any tongue twisters?
Tommy.
Oh, we're getting Tommy as well. I think we've got an extra Olympian.
Hello, this is Tommy.
Hi, Tommy.
Hi, Tommy. We weren't expecting to speak to the whole Finnish team. This is amazing. Finnish tongue twisters. We often ask our guests to give us a tongue twister in their native language.
Yeah, tongue twister. Okay, now we get it. We are millions of them. The whole language is so difficult.
So sometimes if there is like my parents or some Finnish people in the audience, they might say, erittäin ärhäkkää tärpättiä käkättimeen. It's hard to translate what it means, but it's really hard to say.
Oh, wow.
What does it mean?
Oh, I don't know how to translate that.
It'll just have to be a mystery for our listeners.
We'll ask all of our listeners to try and work out what it means without the help of Google Translate.